The Black Shore Arts Hour.
Hello and welcome to episode 83 of the Black Shore Arts Hour. This time we've got something a little bit different for you. We're going to be playing a section of a workshop session that we did recently as part of the Frankie Fightwell extravaganza. This is a panel discussion between Kat Roberts, Chris Buxey, and our very own Matt Boothman, aka MJ Starling. It took place at the Putney Arts Theatre, and it was a lovely opportunity for some local writers to sit with us and work through different ways of writing, the discipline of writing, how to get your work out there. And this was the beginning of that session, and I think that you will find it very interesting.
The Blackshaw Arts Hour.
Ooh, that's a tasty ear treat.
So my name's Matt. I have short stories and a theatre production all published as MJ Starling. So you might have come across my name from those. I have had a production staged with Blackshaw, a few Wandsworth Fringes ago, called Audience with the Ghost Finder.
My name's Kat. I have had my first play produced in 2015 for Blackshaw at the Pleasant Theatre called Staying Alive, and I'm just currently developing another play and writing some spec scripts for television.
And my name's Chris, and I had my first play produced in 2016. Which was The Haunting of Exham Priory, which was an adaptation of the H.P. Lovecraft story, The Rats in the Walls. So that did a sort of tour across the country with Rumpus Theatre. And I'm also the writer for The Final Adventure of Frankie Fightwell, which is on here tonight. And when I'm not doing that, I also write for a webcomic, Baby 001, which was actually just past its 500th episode. So yeah, quite a few of those. So those are my main writing credits.
So let's dive into the deep end with a little bit of talking about physically how we write. So Chris, if we could start with you, what things do you use to write? Like, do you write on a laptop or on paper, etc.? What sort of tools do you have by you when you're doing it?
Well, I sort of fairly exclusively write on sort of desktop computers. The main thing I use for writing is Google Documents. I just find it so useful because Google Documents are very easy to access if you sign up for a Google account. It's free, basically, and it's sort of online word processing. And the advantage is you can access it anywhere. So I could do writing at home in the evenings. I could do a bit of writing at lunchtime during my day job. And you know, you could even use your phone or whatever to do some writing on the train, for example, as long as you've obviously got an internet connection. Google Docs is just so useful because you don't have to carry around a memory stick. You don't have to worry about different versions on different computers. It's always there. And it's a word processor that's online in the browser. It's quite like Microsoft Word, not quite all the bells and whistles, but when you've finished it, at any point, you can download the document from Google Docs as a Word document. So when you're ready to submit it to Google, it's just a useful thing to let you jump in at any point.
So for you, it's about convenience and being able to pick up like whenever the fancy takes you, rather than like having the lucky pen and a nice paper.
Yes, absolutely. It's sort of my philosophy is don't put as few barriers in between you and writing as possible. So if you can access your writing from wherever at any point, you know, and you're ready to go, then. But and it's obviously all backed up on the Google servers as well, so it's sort of you don't lose it accidentally if you lose the memory stick. So.
I think as well that resonates with me in that often I find things come to me when I'm walking around or in the shower, and when you're being quite absent-minded, like creativity comes to you instead of when you're sitting there going, come on, come on. So I think it's important, like Chris says, to have, like I do notes on my phone. My notes thing on my phone is just every now and again there'll just be dialogue there because you have a conversation. I've realised, because to begin with I thought, oh, I'll just remember that, and I'll when I sit down next time I'll come write it, but it goes away again, so you've got to kind of like grab those moments as they come past you, and you have a character idea or an idea for a thing, take them and write them down and so that you can remember, and then when you get to your blank page, you've got at least maybe a scene or a few words to get going with. But I think so often it's the pressure of putting it, you do need to put yourself in that situation and actually do the work, but also remember those moments when you can kind of, when things just come to you, when you're free and easy or having a conversation and you think, oh, that's a good idea. And that might be helpful. For my part, I write on this laptop. I find I can't write pen and paper because I can't write fast enough. When the going is good and things are coming to you, I need to be able to type. I tend to type in Word, and I've just set my margins to know that one page in that particular margin will mean 1 minute of dialogue. So that can be quite helpful, although I usually don't write in that format to begin with, because I find I get very, like, kind of, my ego gets in the way and I get a bit competitive with myself and I start going, well, if I just keep writing, I'll have 90 pages and there'll be 90 shit pages because you haven't, you know what I mean? So I write kind of free in a Word document. I have no idea what's going on, just try and find the characters and get it good, get it going properly before I then go into any kind of format. For screenwriting, I use software called Fadein. There's other ones which are very expensive, and I kind of read a lot about it, and they kind of said, just buy a cheap one while you're trying to break into the industry. Once you've got loads of money and you're a famous screenwriter, then you can get the good stuff.
The one they always cite for script writing for radio or film or anything is Final Draft,
Final Draft.
Is very expensive.
Yeah.
But does everything.
The advice I read, I think Fadein was about 70 quid or something, which it does everything you need, and it will set, I mean, for screenwriting, because they're really strict, everyone's really strict about what page everything happens on and like how long everything is, whereas plays you can kind of do whatever you want. It's quite important to make sure that everything's the right length and in the right format. And
you can use Writer Duet as well, which is free, but you can only save like 3 documents.
I haven't heard of that one.
Useful if you're just getting into it and don't want to spend.
Yeah, exactly. I wouldn't bother investing in the software. Any advice I've looked at kind of said, when you get that good, you could probably just tell a producer to give it to you. Do you know what I mean? so that's me.
Scrivener is another possible one to you. It's one that I've had good experiences with, which is sort of about 30-40 quid, which has kind of presets that can set up for lots of different writing formats. So if you're writing short stories, prose, plays, it has kind of formats set up for those things. And the thing I like about that one is you can structure things in scenes, kind of as file cards on a notice board almost, and it makes it very easy to, if you decide actually that chapter should go earlier in the draft, just to be able to sort of drag it into the right place rather than having to do a big massive copy paste into the somewhere in a Word doc. What about we've touched on this ever so slightly, the blank page problem, the getting started problem. Do either of you have any tips or techniques for just like once you've sat down to start working, how you actually just start getting stuff down on the page? Are there mental blocks that you need to get over? Are there good, bad habits that you consider for this?
Yeah. I always find the first sentence is the hardest when you've got a blank page. I know this isn't much of a technique, but if you just sort of, I find that if you just sit down and then start writing, then the rest flows. So, I mean, if I'm just staring at a blank page trying to think, oh, what are the first few lines going to be? What's the first paragraph going to be? Nothing's really going to come. But if I just start with the first sentence, then I find it sort of naturally flows from there. So just getting the first sentence down is the important thing.
People put a lot of pressure on, especially for prose writing at least, people put a lot of pressure on first sentences, and they're things that get very overanalyzed. So is there a potential to get too wrapped up in, okay, I need to start with the first sentence, but it's got to be perfect, otherwise
yes.
Things won't flow from it.
Well, yeah, I think that, I mean, that is part of the problem. I think when you're sort of doing the first draft, you've just got to remember that it really is the first draft and that you're going to come back and sort of change things. I mean, other things you can get hung up on is sort of when you get to like a new character and you go, oh, I've got to pick a name, so I've now spent 20 or 30 minutes trying to think what's the amazing name for this character.
Or in screenwriting where you have to do a little description and their age, and then you're going, how can I make him sound really interesting, or you know, interesting. Who cares? Just carry on. We'll come back to this. Yeah.
What I sort of tend to do in writing these days is literally just put in very boring, generic placeholder names on my first draft. Bob, basically. You know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, square brackets are your friend.
Yeah.
Things that you can easily do a search for later to know where you've left yourself a placeholder that's like, which I've left myself placeholders before that are literally like, amazing flowery description here. I'm not in the brain space to do it right now, but I will be at some point, so I'll come back and do it when I'm ready.
I mean, the real important thing is that you have a first draft to edit, so even if that doesn't have, you know, good names in it, or so it's the same for like place names or anything like that, it's just get it all down, use sort of rubbish placeholder names, then come back and think of that at leisure. But if you're stopping every, you know, every few minutes to think of a good name for something, then it's really going to slow you down.
It's quite tempting to do that as well, because you're like, I'm working, I'm doing stuff, I'm coming up with names, you know, and you kind of like, you're even worse than me sometimes.
Yeah, I need to do some research
for this.
There are actually lots of good online name generators. Now, I don't sort of, I don't feel comfortable taking the names out of them sort of verbatim, but they're good as like a sort of seed idea, you know, so you can run through just like a list. It will generate you like a list of 10 or 20 character names, then you can like sort of pick bits from each. Oh, that's sort of, you know, appropriate, or you know, if you're really stuck. But I mean, often we're looking for a character name that sort of reflects their, you know, who they are, so, and that's something that a random generator can't give you. But again, it's useful if you're sort of stuck and you want something just to go in the gap.
Me?
any more on this topic?
A good habit I formed recently, I read the Stephen King book on writing, which is a really good book if you want to read one. He said you have to be willing to go into a room and close the door and not come out until you have your word count for anything. And I've started doing that. I wake up at 6 and I don't come out until I've written 1,000 words, which is about 10 pages of dialogue. And that's 10 pages of new dialogue every day. And it doesn't have to be anything. And there'll be days where, like, you've had an argument with somebody and it's all you can think about. So that can be your dialogue for the day. Write that scene, write that conversation, write why you're so annoyed. You know, like, but make sure you get your 1,000. And it's really about discipline and getting in the rhythm. And you'll be amazed what starts to come out when you just get going. But for me, I find similar things like coming up with names. I don't even sometimes put names down the side of the page. I just write the dialogue. I don't know who's speaking the words or whatever. But as you get going, you start thinking, oh, what if this guy was, you know, you start creating in your mind the situation. Because naturally, we're all storytellers, born storytellers. That's how we communicate. It's like who we are. So it's all in you. And it's just really, a lot of the time, giving yourself a chance to let it come out. The only way to do that is to be at work. I can't remember where the quote comes from, that genius arrives when you're at work. And I think that is true. You might write and your first, you know, however many pages of dialogue are terrible, but you know you have to get to 1,000 words, so you keep going. You might take, you know, 3 lines out of that at the end of the day, but it might spark something in you. Next day you come and think, I'm going to explore that idea now with my 1,000 words today. The other thing he said was to write with the door closed, edit with the door open. And I really like that advice, because so much, and I don't know what kind of hang-ups you have, but everyone has hang-ups, everyone has things that prevent them from starting. Again, remember, like Chris said, it is a first draft. No one's going to read it until you give it to them. So you have the opportunity to go back and create a story out of it. But like you say, you have to get something down before you can start moulding it and making it what it needs to be.
A really, really common pitfall is this attitude, which I think is sold to us by a lot of media about writing, which is that you have to wait for inspiration to strike.
Yeah,
you can't. You've just got to sit down. You've got to sit down and do things, and some days you will feel inspired and some days you won't, and it's about finding out what you are capable of doing on the days when you don't feel super energized about it.
Yeah.
That might be a day when you can do a bit of research, or when you can do a bit of editing, or even just like bash out a horrible 1,000 words that you're really not happy with.
Yeah.
But that you have to give yourself permission for your first draft to suck.
Yeah.
I've heard it said that the first draft is where you tell the story to yourself, and then any previous drafts are you finding the way to tell the story to other people.
That's good.
So Kat, I want to talk to you specifically about dialogue. You've started talking a little bit about it, but do you have any tips or techniques or anything that you've learned about specifically finding the balance between dialogue that works dramatically but also feels real and believable and realistic?
I think that kind of comes down to intention and obstacle, which is that in life you could spend an hour pottering around having meaningless conversation. It sounds really real, but no one's going to want to watch that. Do you know what I mean? And the difference is that in drama, there has to be something that happens. So it's like life at the worst bit, where it all comes together. So that's then to do with structure. So the main thing, I think, is to figure out what your characters want and what is going to get in their way. And those obstacles can be internal, they can be a flaw that they have within themselves, or they can be external. An example today, because I was nearly late, my intention was to get here half an hour early. My obstacle was the Victoria line and the various other things that happened along the way. I did manage to get here on time, but the way I was feeling when I left was very different from the way I was feeling when I arrived. And I think that's it. It's in motion. And in dialogue is, I suppose, characters' attempts to deal with those obstacles, to try and get what they want, to try and get where they're going. And I think that's the difference, in that you can sit and write, and I love to do it, and then you have to edit all out. Sit and write a lovely conversation between two people, but you know, nothing happens, nothing moves the story forward. So you've always got to be doing that. However subtly, maybe they don't even know that they want this thing, but they always have to want something. In terms of actually writing dialogue that sounds authentic, I just have a bit of an obsession with the way people speak and the way that they handle themselves, so I just listen a lot to people on trains. Are great, especially when they forget they're on a train, and phone conversations are great. I used to, from like quite a young age, write down people's phone conversations on trains, then I would study what they had said, and then a good thing to do is maybe go back and try and fill in the other half of the conversation with various, you know, you could do it multiple different ways, and then you could say, well, let's raise the stakes. Why are they going? Why are they on this train? Why are they so upset? Or why are they so happy? And then you can kind of try and create the story around that. I've gone on for ages.
that technique of kind of actually writing down, transcribing actual conversations you're hearing out in the wild is really interesting. Mm. It's a way of almost like training yourself into muscle memory of writing patterns of speech.
Yeah.
I have to transcribe a lot of workshops and roundtables and things for my day job, so I kind of find myself trained into that a little bit. And I've heard, this isn't something that I ever did, but a few writers that I've heard talking about their technique have said they got their start by effectively just like copying out from books they admired. Again, almost to just deal with that white page problem of,
yeah,
I'm typing something now and the stuff that is coming out on the page looks good because it's from a published book by a good author who I like. But also just to sort of train your brain and your fingers and your muscle memory, mm-hmm, and the storytelling part of your storytelling muscles into, this is what a good story that I like looks like, and this is what it feels like to produce one. And
yeah,
then you kind of know when you're hitting that sweet spot when you do it with your own original material.
I think as well to notice in your own life moments where you were made to feel a certain way, or you witnessed something in which there was a nuanced moment, and think about what did those people actually say? Probably, you know, not at all what was made to be felt. People never really say what they want to say. It's always the subtext beneath it. So in those moments where you think, oh, that was weird, or that made me feel really happy, or I really didn't like the way he just spoke to her. If you wrote down what they actually said, those are quite good ways of then you think back and you can kind of recreate those moments or call back to them.
How much of the kind of ums, ahs, false starts, broken sentences and things do you actually put on the page?
All of them, pretty much. I really enjoy writing dialogue where people interrupt each other and talk. People interrupt and talk over the top of each other all the time. So yeah, often I'll write a sentence and then that you put a cut in the middle, and it means that the actor would, with the next line, just start halfway through that person's sentence. It works really well in kind of arguments where people are trying so hard to prove their point and not listening to each other at all.
And so, Kat, you've written for stage and you're starting to write for screen.
Yeah.
Chris, you've written prose, you've written comics dialogue, you've written for stage and radio. Have either of you noticed any kind of differences in the way dialogue works in different media?
Yeah, so there's quite a few differences, really. I mean, for coming to radio after doing sort of dialogue for stage, there are some differences, as much as the characters have to say each other's names perhaps a bit more than you would in a sort of normal conversation with someone. You just want to be clear who you're talking to. Similarly, there's a bit more sort of, you know, describing, you know, people almost sort of narrating their actions in a way. I mean, just, you know, saying so it's clear. I mean, so much you can pick up with sound effects when you're doing radio, but
things like "let me just take that mug off you."
Yes, basically, yeah. So there's that. I mean, writing for comics is kind of like writing for Twitter, I guess, as well. You're trying to fit things within a tiny sort of speech bubble area, and you've just got to be sort of, you know, really concise. It's writing for comics is actually a good way of sort of practicing getting across your message without any sort of superfluous dialogue. You know, sometimes I'll write the script for the episode and then go to try and fit it on the page. Like, oh no, this is off the edge. This is too long, right? Let's cut this down. Let's split it over more panels.
I guess it must be quite good discipline being your own letterer.
Yes.
If you're not writing this and asking somebody else to cram it all on the page.
Exactly, yes. I'm not just writing it and thinking, oh, this is somebody else's problem. You know, they've got to make it fit. So, I think there are real differences between all the different mediums. They're all their own sort of disciplines, really.
So what about sort of between stage and screen specifically? Because they're kind of superficially, on the page, quite similar ways of writing.
Yes.
But are there key differences?
No, I think the main thing, and this is where I really struggle, is that I love dialogue. And you just can't write that much of it off the screen. You really need to visualise, and almost you are the camera, and if you can do something visually, you should do it visually every single time. And I struggle because I'm not very good at prose, but you have to kind of figure out how to write action in an interesting way so that what you're seeing in your head translates to whoever picks up that script and reads it. And whereas on stage you might say, you know, why are you looking at me like that? Because the audience can't really see every expression, and you have to kind of, on screen, you can just show nuances. You can just show something happening in the distance or far away, or, you know, you can tell the story in such a different way.
You can control where the audience is looking.
Yeah, basically, exactly. That's exactly it. And so dialogue, really, you shouldn't need too much of it, unless...
On screen, you think there should be less dialogue.
If you can do something visually, or find a way to, you should always be looking to do that first.
Yeah.
On screen,
okay.
Yeah.
I heard in the TV programme Lewis that the two main actors who did it for years used to have competitions of like who could say the least and do it in the least way possible with it still kind of translated.
Yeah, this is what that, like all the old hoary writing advice cliches like kill all your darlings and cut 90% mean.
Yeah.
Is if you can do without it, you should.
Mm.
If you can take something out and the story still functions and the audience still understands what's happening, then you didn't need it, even if it was such a lovely phrase that you really wanted to
keep. Yeah, I definitely struggle with that. I think in plays you just have a bit more leeway, don't you? You don't have to write to a really specific structure, or you know, they're in screen, they're like, right, it's page 10 or whatever, where's my inciting incident, where's my, you know what I mean? That's how people read them, I think. Whereas in plays, you can just have it any length you want.
Yeah, and you can blur the boundaries between scene transitions on the stage much more easily than on TV as well. Like on TV, there's a cut and we've moved somewhere else. Whereas you can start to blend locations and play around with what time means on the stage.
Yeah. I think radio as well. I mean, I don't write for radio. I haven't written for radio, so I don't. But I would imagine just to be able to use sound in a much more interesting way. I was listening to a good radio play called The Homecoming. I don't know if anybody's heard that.
Pinter.
No. It's just a new radio play.
I was
going to
know that one.
And it was really good. It was about military, and they utilised telephone conversations very well. Somebody walking through an airport and having a very fractured conversation, they're shouting at somebody, but then there's a tannoy and a thing. You know, you really could see what they were doing, even though it was audio. And also interview techniques, so you can have people sitting at a table talking for half an hour, which you can't do on stage. It'd be boring.
So, Chris, you have now written the video.
Mm-hmm.
What did you learn? Because you wrote Frankie Fight Well originally as a stage play.
Mm-hmm.
So what did you learn from the process of taking something that was written for stage and converting it to work for radio?
Yes, well, as Matt said, Frankie Fight Well started off as an early draft. It was sort of a stage play. But I'm really glad we did change it to a radio play, because I think it really sort of benefited from that. I think getting to use the sounds to create some of the effects was good. I mean, I don't just particularly talk about the story in too much detail, sure, in case anyone's going to sort of see it tonight, but I mean,
were there changes that you had to make to dialogue? Were there changes you had to make to like how scenes are constructed?
Yes, yeah. I mean, as I was saying earlier, you know, people actually sort of introduce themselves a bit more and narrate what they're doing, but so I'm just trying to think of a way to explain it. But I like the fact that in radio you can sort of make the listener do some of the work, if you see what I mean. Now that may sound like a cop out as a writer, but for some of the things in the play, for some of the creatures in the play, whatever you had on the stage probably wouldn't match what was in the people's imagination. But when it becomes a radio play, then it all goes into the imagination. So, I mean, part of when I'm doing something like that, I just like to keep the descriptions down a bit for like sort of physical details. So although I'll be describing actions, but the details of what is actually happening, I think it's better if the listeners sort of fill that in themselves. So when you're describing something that Frankie finds particularly horrific, I don't go into detail on it, because whatever I describe is not going to be as good as what the listener can imagine, because the own person's imagination is just, you know, much more powerful. If I describe it in too much detail, it's just going to be a bit anticlimactic. They're going to come, well, I imagine it a bit better than that. So it's better just to leave some of the detail off, I think, and just don't waste time in your, you know, in your radio play describing things. Just let them, you know, let them imagine it.
I think that's, sorry, just an interesting point as well, is a good time to mention the danger of exposition when you're writing, in the just certain rules, like characters should never say something to somebody that person would clearly already know. Do you know what I mean? So you have to find interesting ways in which to reveal information without characters just going, hey, you know.
As you know.
As you know, yeah. I haven't been feeling well, you know, or whatever.
No, that's a very good point. Yeah. So there is, I think, there was basically one point. There is one point in Frankenfight where someone does have to announce themselves as who they are, because I just could not think of a way for it to come up naturally in conversation. But, it was, but yeah, you're quite right. You have to sort of avoid it otherwise, but I think I've managed to avoid it in most places. But it is hard sometimes.
It can be quite a trap, especially when you're first starting out, that just trying to find ways for people to bring stuff up so you can get the action moving and fill in the audience with information.
Yeah, I like to think of a lot of, like, basically any form of writing that involves an audience, whether that's a reader reading a book or somebody listening to a radio play or somebody in the audience of the stage play, everything is a collaboration with the person who's experiencing it. And I don't know whether perhaps some perhaps with some forms the balance is different. So it sounds like maybe with radio it's you're expecting the audience to fill in a bit more themselves, whereas for something that's very kind of visually immersive like cinema, you're doing a lot more of the work for them. But sort of do you feel that you are supplying work up to a point and then allowing the audience to collaborate with you in their own kind of consumption of it?
Yeah, I'd say so, definitely, yeah.
I think that's a problem I have actually, and worked with Ellie on Staying Alive to try and get rid of some of my kind of over-explanation and kind of slightly... You need to trust your audience that they get it, and sometimes you're going to go, no, but this is my theme. This is what I'm writing about, guys. They go, yeah, no, they get it. It's kind of allowing them, allowing, like you say, the audience to fill in the gaps and figure out what that means to them. It might mean something different to them than it does to you, and that's absolutely fine. Someone told a story recently about an opera singer who's singing and so into her singing that she started crying, and the teacher went up and slapped her in the face and she said, "We're meant to be crying, not you." Do you know what I mean? That you're meant to make them feel it. No, I didn't know who that was.
Yeah, I mean, someone's already crying and he slapped her. Yeah. That's just mean.
Yeah, hardcore opera trading.
Question for either of you about the kind of the mediums that you have been drawn to, that you have found yourselves writing in. Are there things about stage, about audio, about comics, about any of those media that particularly excite you, or that you feel like there are things that you can only do in that medium?
That's a good question.
Like, are there things that, for instance, audio drama does that no other medium can, or the audio drama does better than any other medium? And is there anything that's sort of the same for stage or TV?
For stage, I suppose there's the aspect just that it's live, and there's every show will be different, but maybe you do have an audience sitting there, so I think that's something you can potentially play with that you can't really do in any other form. And you do get now immersive theatre or something, things that try to involve an audience, and that's quite interesting. Now you can access media all the time, so that I find that exciting, that something, it's almost like the only form left that is its own authentic thing in the moment when you're there, and that's very cool.
Even with NT Live.
Yeah, NT Live as well.
It's not exactly the same though, is it?
I don't know, I've never actually seen one.
Anything, Chris? Or is this too much of a stumper?
Yeah, I'm a bit stumped though.
Well, let's bring it back around to the actual process of writing. I know we had a couple of questions about getting beyond draft one, and the advice I would give is always finish the first draft. This is a thing I've struggled with, is being tempted to start revising before you get to the end, which you cannot. Don't do it. You don't know what revisions it needs until you've finished it. But for the two of you, like, a kind of simple numerical question first of all, like, how many drafts is normal for you before something's done?
Probably three or four, I'd say. I mean, the second draft seems to be the biggest revision, and then like three and four are sort of tweaks, basically.
I just don't. This is where I absolutely go to pieces. Editing and redrafting is, I find it so hard. I write a lot of things in my head before I ever put them on the page, or I will write, like I say, out of format, and then I will write a bit here and a bit here and a bit here, almost like kind of manipulate myself to get it done, and then finally put it all together. So actually I don't do that many full drafts, because once it's in, I find it so hard to edit it in any way. It's like, feels like, I don't know, like Jenga or something, you know, and you're just like, I take that out and suddenly the whole thing's fallen over. So a couple. The play I'm writing right now, I've done about five because it's just not working. But
can I ask for drafts, whether you mean like a full revision, a blank page, so, again? Or
I mean, it sounds like we've sort of got two different techniques. Like, Chris,
I think...
Do you do, like, I finished the first draft, now I'm going to go back to the top and...
I think it might be sort of as a result of my like technical and scientific background, but yeah, I have very neatly version numbered documents and then do a full sort of review of the whole thing, and then that is a draft, and then start again from the beginning when it's time, you know, to do the next draft, or when I've had feedback from any sort of test readers or anything. But that is literally personal choice. I'm not saying that is the way to do it. That's just, you know, I think sort of what I'm used to, basically.
So. Yeah, whereas I will do that, start again from a blank page. So take the first draft in a window to one side, blank page in a window to the other side, and just start typing it out again and making changes as I do that. I just find that less of a... Like, if I'm going through text that's already there and deciding which of these words shall I change, I find that I'm drawn to leave things as they are, whereas if I'm starting again, typing it all out again, I might as well change the thing I'm thinking of changing. So I find it easier to actually change things and make the necessary edits that way.
I'm going to try that. I haven't done that before. I heard a thing that Aaron Sorkin, who writes, even when he's finished and he thinks he's got it, he does that, writes it again, because he'll inevitably come up with something and go, oh, actually, you know, he's like, if it's bad, he can't bring himself to write it again, even though he's just copying. And then he does it once without the script and writes the whole thing again. And just like he says, some things just pop in which are new and good, and or take characters in a different direction. Yeah, I think it's interesting, like you say, it's all about mindset, isn't it? So, like, your mind's very clever at kind of going, it will take the path of least resistance. So if it's there and it's already on the page, you're like, oh, just leave it, even when it's not good.
So just to make a quick distinction between line edits, so going through word by word and saying, does this need changing, does that need changing, and structural edits, saying, do I need this scene? Does this scene belong where it is, etc.? Looking at the structural side of it, how do we approach that? How do you make that decision about what you can afford to cut, what you need to keep, whether things are in the right order? Do you just kind of get an instinctive feel for it? Is it based on feedback?
That's kind of a tricky one to answer, because yes, I think it is kind of instinct. I mean, the way I sort of tend to approach stories is I always start knowing sort of, you know, approximately what I want to happen. So I know what the start is, I know what the middle is, I know what the end is. And again, this is just my preference. What I tend to do is sort of like, when I'm doing my very first draft, I tend to do sort of bullet points. So, you know, I don't know, dramatic incident one is this, dramatic incident two is this, dramatic incident three is this. And then those bullet points become paragraphs, and then I go and fill in the gaps between them to sort of link them together, sort of story-wise. But in terms of structure edits and how to move it around, I think that's kind of just instinct, really. It's sort of like, it's knowing, you know, keeping up the pace. I mean, because I think as Kat said earlier, everything's got to sort of advance the story, and, you know, occasionally you'll have something that's perhaps a bit less exciting, but you need it for some reason that pays off later on. But it's just a case of trying not to get bogged down in too many of those bits in a row, and so not having like a lot of this will pay off later bits that are sort of not that interesting at the time, and then a load of action, and, you know, try to sort of balance it out a bit more, basically.
Is it very different between sort of revising stage work, and you were talking about TV work being quite prescriptive in terms of where the beats need to fall? Is there a difference between the two?
Yeah, I think probably just that some you're likely to get something, a note of that nature if you were to do that, like you're missing this turning point at your end of your, you know, or you spend too long in the scene because you just don't have the you have to be really, it is quite prescriptive and people want things on certain pages. I like to get feedback. I find that really helpful. So that brings in the audience element, and it might be that you intended to do something with the scene, and an audience member will just go, I didn't feel that at all. And then you think, right, maybe it's in the wrong place. Maybe it needs to be somewhere else, or there's a better way of making people feel and see this thing that I wanted them to see. Audience can be quite helpful in that way, or a character might be coming across glib when you meant them to be charming, you know, or you know, and then you can go back and look at that. At the end of the day, it is about the audience. So getting that feedback and moving through and hearing your work out loud once you've finished it, things will occur to you that you didn't realise before. Actors are great because they care so much about the words they're speaking. They'll often be like, why do I say this bit? Why do I say? And if you don't know why, then it does help you. Their questions about character, or you suddenly realise, God, that actor hasn't spoken for 5 scenes. These characters are barely in this play. Do I need them, or are they just facilitating something else? Can I lose them? Can I find a different way to do it? All of that stuff's really helpful, and it's hard to see when you're just writing.
Yeah, because it can be very easy to fall into a perspective where you're looking at the work as a whole and not realising that, like you said, there might be an individual character whose emotional journey or arc just isn't working or doesn't make any sense, but you don't notice that until there is a person who's laser focusing on that character and their journey.
Yeah.
Talking about feedback from other people, is that something you seek as well, Chris?
Yes. Well, I was just going to say... just to add to what Kat was saying about audience feedback, I'd say don't take, if you're getting people to sort of read your piece before it's, you know, finished, you get them to read drafts, don't get hung up on the feedback from one person or from one audience, because different people will react differently. I mean, when I started writing for stage, this was something that I found fascinating. For my first play, when it was on tour in different venues, and I went to see it at a couple of venues, and for different venues and different nights, the audience reacted completely differently to different bits, which I found fascinating. Like, it was a horror, so there weren't that many like jokes, but there were some light-hearted bits. They sort of, different audiences laughed at different bits, and different audiences gasped at different reveals. So. I mean, if you're getting feedback from someone says, you know, oh, I didn't like this bit, then that doesn't mean you've got to take it out. I mean, see what other people think. Get a sort of range of feedback. The first person you ask might not like a scene, but, you know, the next 5 people might say, oh, this is brilliant, this is my favourite bit. So I'd say if you have proofreaders, if you have test audiences, definitely try and have more than 1 or 2.
And give them a brief. Don't just hand over a piece of work to somebody and say, please give me feedback on this. Tell them what you're looking for. Tell them what you're struggling with, or the type of feedback that you want from them, because it helps them. Because it's a big ask to be given a draft of a novel or a draft of a play and asked to give feedback on it. And it helps people. It'll help people actually do it in a timely manner if you give them a brief and say, what I'm really focused on is, does the main character's journey make sense, or is it funny enough, or did you feel like there was enough of an emotional turning point at the end, and those sorts of things, because it just helps people. It means that their feedback will actually be useful rather than you getting a lot of when feedback's not what you want to hear, it can be quite disheartening. So it helps if it's directed, so even if it is still something you didn't want to hear, it's something that you knew was a potential issue going in.
Yeah, I think as well, prepare for the emotional impact when you ask for feedback and you get it. You're like, oh, God. What I really wanted you to say was, it's the most perfect thing I've ever read. No one will ever say that if you really want to know.
I heard Phoebe Waller-Bridge say, you know, I mainly want praise.
That is fine. It is fine to say that
I
also, to people.
You know, I didn't want to hear anything that was but I mainly want prep.
Yeah. But I do think Matt's right. If you focus those questions, I want to know if these characters are funny or if this scene works. For, you know, does it do what it intended? If you just say, give me feedback, you might be in for a bit
it's
of
absolutely
a beating.
Fine. It's fine to say, I need encouragement.
Yeah.
You know, I want to keep at this, so I need you to praise me a little bit, but also give me some feedback.
Remember, I'm fragile.
I think we're coming towards the end of this portion, but I just want to wrap up with a sort of quick question of if there's one piece of sort of kind of key writing advice that you wish you had had earlier, that if you could go back in time and give your younger self a piece of writing advice, what would that be?
Mine, I think, comes from, I listened to a BAFTA screenwriting podcast with Charlie Kaufman, the writer, and he said the major obstacle to people completing things is the deep-seated belief that they are not interesting. And he said, if that's true of you, then just agree, say, I'm not interesting, but I want to offer something, and this is what I have to give. Take your ego out of it, take all of it off the table, and just offer what you have. And if you do that, and you do it honestly, it will affect people and it will help people.
I think, for me, it's an interesting question. I think, ultimately, I probably wouldn't give my past self any advice. I'd just go back and taunt them. I sort of, because, I mean, I made a lot of mistakes along the way, but sort of making them got me to where I am, so I wouldn't want... sorry, it's a bit of a metaphysical question. I wouldn't want my
trust the physicist.
Yeah, I wouldn't want my past self to not sort of make all the mistakes, because I did sort of... You know, I started off writing and I wrote all sorts of terrible things and sort of, you know, tried to emulate the style of my favourite writers before I settled into my own style. But, I mean, that's sort of part of the learning process. But one thing I do suffer from a bit is sort of like imposter syndrome. You know, I'm like, oh no, maybe are people going to realise I'm not a real writer? But... But I think the thing is that if you're writing, then you are a writer, regardless of whether you've been produced or published yourself. If you're writing, even if it's just for yourself, then you are a writer. So never think that you're not a writer just because you haven't yet been published or produced.
Yeah, follow writers on Twitter and you will find that all the writers that you admire who appear to be having very, very successful careers still think that. Still think, when am I going to be discovered? So I just want to wrap up with a disclaimer, kind of, for everything that we've said and every piece of writing advice you will ever hear in your life, which is that every piece of writing advice comes with an unspoken disclaimer that this is what works for me at the moment for this piece. So if you hear from a writer you admire, the secret to writing is you have to write every day. And you can't do that. That does not mean that you are failing. It means that piece of advice is not right for you for the piece of work that you're working on at the moment. So it's about, you can pick and choose. It's about finding the advice that people give that works for you and assembling like the patchwork of all of those bits of advice that works for you personally for the piece that you are working on right now. And that's that.
That is that indeed. What a fascinating conversation, led masterfully by our very own Matt Boothman. So, if you're interested in writing, I've got extra good news for you. We've got continued discussion of writing from that workshop, which we'll be playing in our next episode. We'll also see the return of Strat and Alex Do Art, and I don't mean to panic you, but they're trying their hand at the art of haiku. So, brace yourselves, everybody. In the meantime, excellent news for podcast fans, because the new season of Merely Role Players, our sister podcast, has officially begun. You can tune in now and listen to the latest instalment. It's called Let's Get Gideon, and it's a very exciting heist. I know how it ends because I done been in it, but you don't, so I recommend a listen. We will be back in 2 weeks' time, so until then, enjoy yourselves. Bye.
Go on, treat yourself to something.
Subscribe to the Blackshaw Arts Hour on your generic podcast resource.
You deserve it.